happy Easter afternoon. How's that?
That was good.
Kind of dates our show, but too bad. It's Easter. That's kind of awesome.
We're all over it.
And we were going to take the day off, but then we made a last minute. It was kind of like you were going to miss your exit because you were driving on the freeway and you get like that. And then you go, oh my gosh, it's my exit. That's what I did last night.
Yeah. And it worked out.
I reached out to our friend William Kay and, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? Hey, what are you doing tomorrow? And then we took the exit.
Yeah.
And here we are. So my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we have our friend from Canada, William Kay.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hiding in the telephone there. How's it going?
Very well.
Well, Bill's had these trade shows and not complaining because he's, you know, back to work and all that.
Gainfully employed.
Yeah. That sounds so. I just got out of jail. Well, maybe that's just how
right,
so.
No, let's clear that up right now. That is not the case.
I'm gainfully employed.
He got an amnesty by Obama.
He got his driver's license back and everything.
I know it. I'm somebody.
You got to say it right, though. I'm somebody.
That's right.
So, I don't know, just thought it was kind of a bad deal to do to folks, although it's Easter Sunday, so they're probably not listening anyway.
Oh, they are listening.
Oh.
They were hoping we'd be here.
Really?
Absolutely.
They're rubbing their little hands together?
Kids are all out gathering their little Easter eggs,
and the parents are like,
We the People Radio.
What are these guys going to talk about
today?
I hope
you hit them good. It'd take them a long time to find them.
So we're just kind of winging it. Yeah. We're winging it with William Kay.
So Bill is one of the reasons the employment picture is looking better.
There you go.
That's right. I added to the numbers.
Uh-huh.
The dismal numbers.
I don't know. It's pretty hard because we don't calculate the numbers of actually people who are unemployed. We only count people who are on unemployment, right?
No,
isn't that the deal?
Yeah.
The people
who
stopped getting...
But they don't count the people who quit being
that's
on
what
unemployment
I mean.
And still are unemployed.
Right.
Yeah.
So we don't actually count the real unemployed
and we don't
people.
Count the people who are underemployed, those working part-time who wish to work full-time.
Oh,
yeah.
You're right.
The 20-hour-a-week people.
Yeah, like the lovely young man who helped me at AutoZone down in Chico last week. Mm-hmm. I had to get a... steering wheel cover because, I don't know, I'm having this thumb problem anyway. And there was no way I was stretching this stupid steering wheel cover over my steering wheel because you had to be a big-time wrestler in order to do it. And
big-time AutoZone.
And the kid's like, oh, yeah, hey, I'll help you out with that. So he comes out and does all that. Nicest guy. And I guess he works there full-time and he works at Home Depot part-time. And
oh, so he's hogging somebody else's
job. Yeah, but he
had... Well, no wonder the employment numbers are wrong.
Exactly. He had multiple jobs, and I thought...
He's skewing him the wrong way.
Yeah.
Oh, what a nice guy. I hope he finds a real job that pays him well. So anyway, I didn't catch his name. I was going to send his manager a nice note, and I was like, oh, great. I look at my receipt later. He's cashier number 12. I'd like to compliment number 12.
Shout out to cashier number 12.
Cash out to number 12. I was like, dang it. I could have looked at his name
Thanks
tag.
Thanks for that shout out, Bob. I'm sure he appreciates it.
So I would have liked to have given the kid a, I don't know, I'll figure out who he is.
Shout out to Canada. Eh?
Yeah. Can you tell me who's number 12? So, William, what do you guys have up there? Do you guys have this big unemployment deal, too, or did you guys give up on that a long time ago and just
Typically,
lie about it?
It's a little higher in Canada than the United States.
Really?
We have the same sort of statistical problem. They don't count people who are not gainfully looking for employment. What they do is a telephone survey, which is going to miss a lot of people. And you have to say that you've been looking for work in the last period of time. But a lot of these centers have such high unemployment, there's really no point for the people to be looking.
Well, no, because you...
Count. They don't count Indians on reserves. They don't count people in prison. You know, there's all sorts of ways in which they... skewer the numbers. It's always better to look at just the actual number of people who are employed.
Even that's
a guesstimate.
Do you guys have unemployment? Like when people lose their job, do you have a certain period of time? Like do you pay into unemployment and then they kind of...
Well, we used to call it unemployment insurance. They changed the name to employment insurance. That made everybody a lot happier.
Oh, sure.
And there's all sorts of these typical social programs. There's welfare, old age supplement.
Yeah, but you guys
it's more of a welfare state in Canada than the United States.
But you guys in Canada, when you're unemployed, you can go out and cut wood and mine and do all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah,
we can't do that down
here. Trap beaver.
Okay, that's where I was going. Canoe out in the wilderness, and shoot bows and arrows and wear pelts.
William's up there with his fuzzy raccoon hat on.
Yeah, totally different.
Stagecoach.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, You were saying, and I mean, we didn't really talk so much about what we were going to do, but you were talking about Syria, and you said you were gonna cram. So for the last few hours that we've been walking the dog, goofing off, and that sort of thing, because we went to church last night, we got a kind of a little jump on it there. But you had said that you want to talk about Syria.
Well, that's what was on my mind.
Fire away.
I think what happened earlier this month was such a stark reversal within the Trump administration, and such a 180-degree turn. People talk about regime change in Syria. You just had regime change in the United States. That was such a change, and it happened so quickly. It appears to me, it all ties into the environmental stuff, but there's a real danger now that if Trump is capable of such a stark change of opinion in foreign policy, it seems to be that he might be capable of doing that regarding any policy. This is a person who someone bothered to count on 45 times, said that he would not, you know, get engaged in Syria. He criticized Hillary Clinton rightly for advocating no-fly zones and what have you in Syria that would probably provoke World War III. And then after that chemical attack, you know, according to my timeline, I went this. The New York Times got this sort of. It was 63 hours between the chemical attack and the American response, the cruise missile attack. But it was less than 36 hours from the chemical attack to the decision to bomb Syria, and it just you know it beggars the imagination how that could possibly have happened. And the likelihood of, I agree with Ron Paul, the likelihood of the Assad regime causing that chemical attack is zero. That simply did not happen. That was so obviously a staged event by Al-Qaeda. I would go one step further. The likelihood of Trump and Tillerson and those people believing that Assad was responsible is zero. They could not possibly believe that they actually did that.
How come the Russians haven't come out and said that Assad wasn't responsible? They've been kind of quiet.
They have? It hasn't been reported in the Western media. Breitbart reported it. If you go to RT, the Russian television station, Putin, in as many words, said this is a false flag operation. This was a fake operation done by Al-Qaeda, in as many words. His spokesperson said the term false flag, and that was a direct quote from Putin.
And so what's the benefit of the United States by creating a false flag?
Well, the Americans didn't do it. The Al-Qaeda did it.
Okay.
The town where this happened, Khan Shikun is the name of the town, has been in the control of Al-Qaeda for at least 4 years now, like fully in the control. So for the first 2 or 3 days after this attack, the entire crime scene, if you will, was still completely in control of Al-Qaeda. There wasn't a Western journalist in there for a couple of days. So all of the information that we were getting from about this chemical attack was coming through. Well, it's called, you know, it goes through many names. Al-Qaeda has changed its name 3 or 4 times in Syria. They're fooling nobody. But, you know, you had BBC, Reuters, all these different news agencies reporting this chemical attack, assuring us that it was nerve gas, assuring us that it was from an aircraft had delivered it. 100% of that information was coming from Al-Qaeda. There wasn't a single Western correspondent in that town for the first few days. The Trump administration made the decision to respond by force before a single Western journalist had entered that town.
And so how did Al-Qaeda get the chemical weapons? Did they steal them from Assad?
Couple of theories. There's one theory that it wasn't nerve gas.
A lot
of the reports was that it had a powerful smell, like a powerful odor to it.
Like chlorine.
Chlorine or one of the other sort of cheapo chemical weapons, because nerve gas has no smell. Also, the initial photographs of the Al-Qaeda types inspecting the crater in the ground, nobody's wearing hazmat uniforms.
Right.
You'd be dead as a doorknob if there was sarin gas around there. There was a variety of other things like that that led people to believe that maybe it wasn't. nerve gas. It could have been some cheapo stuff. However, it's likely that Turkey might have stashes of nerve gas. They might have given them to the Syrian opposition. I think they go by the name of Tarin al-Sham now. But before that, they were the al-Nusra Front that controls this town. And that group was the official franchise operation of al-Qaeda in Syria and had been since 2011. But they've gone through a series of rebrandings and name changes. There's always an effort to make them appear to be a moderate force, when in fact they're the same sort of extremist Islamist, jihadist, terrorist groups as the rest of them. But without a doubt, and all the New York Times reported that ISIS and al-Qaeda and this whole sort of milieu of movement in there, they've used chemical weapons over 60 times. So it's not beyond them to do it. And you have to just sit back for a second and say, what would motivate Assad and the Russians to use a chemical attack like that? I mean, the town had no strategic military value.
Other than it was occupied by his enemies.
Sure.
The actual residential area that got hit didn't have any military value. It was in their territory. Now, I'm glad that you're taking an oppositional view to this. But you think one commentator was describing, if they really wanted to, kill those civilians in that neighborhood, why wouldn't they just drop a barrel bomb on them? Have they done that? I mean, Assad has done that before.
Well, he did it after the strike, too, didn't he?
There was an attack on a medical clinic hours after the strike. Once again, there still were no Western journalists around. This is entirely the narrative of al-Qaeda. But the argument was that first there was this chemical attack. We can get into the details. It's very, very dubious. Then hours later, there was an attack on the medical facility where a lot of the patients were being taken. And this was done presumably to cover up the evidence, although it certainly didn't, and it's hard to see how it could have. But there definitely was an airstrike on that town. Initially, the Russians and Syrians thought they might have hit a chemical storage dump controlled by al-Qaeda. That was their initial speculation. But as sort of, a few days went by, it's becoming increasingly obvious that, no, that was actually a chemical release done, deliberately by al-Qaeda.
Not from the air.
What they've got is a crater on the street, about 4 feet wide, 1 foot deep. And it is, it was at the time downwind or sort of upwind from where the village, not the village, but sort of the neighborhood that got gas was. So whoever released that canister of gas, if it was indeed released from that crater where al-Qaeda said it was released from, had to have known what direction the wind was blowing. So what they keep showing us is this photograph of this little crater in the middle of the road with this cylinder in it. There's an MIT professor called Theodore Postol. He's investigated these things before, and he keeps looking at this photograph, and he says a number of things about it. One, if you look at the cylinder, it's split from stem to stern. And he said, that's the sort of destruction you would get if the cylinder had been laid on the ground on its side and an explosion had occurred above it. It wouldn't break apart that way if it was just fired directly into the ground. Mm. Also, whoever fired that cylinder, if it was fired from an aircraft, had to know what direction the breeze was blowing on the ground, and a pilot way up in the air wouldn't know that. And there's only this single canister. Typically, when an aircraft is going to deliver chemical munitions, they drop a large canister, which is full of small metal balls. The metal balls contain the poison, the chemicals. And inside each little metal ball, there's another chamber with a very small explosion. So you drop a large canister, it breaks apart in the air. And then you've got, 100 little baseballs falling towards the earth. On impact, each little baseball bursts open. The amount of explosive is not even a teaspoon. It's just enough to burst the ball open. But because you've got hundreds of little balls, you get dispersal of the chemical agent. If you're just, no one's ever heard of like firing a rocket straight into the dirt as a means of dispersing a chemical agent. Had that rocket, according to theory, hit soft ground, gone through the roof of a building, hit a, you know, a pond or a swamp, it wouldn't have dispersed the agent at all.
Right.
So that MIT prof says, you know, no way does anyone, you know, fire chemical weapons like shooting a rocket straight into the ground from extremely high altitude, that you cause a crater in an asphalt road. No, that's not how anybody disperses agents. You know, the likelihood of you, you know, just sinking it into a wet ditch somewhere and killing no one is too high. And allegedly, all of the fatalities result from this one rocket, which, you know, in retrospect is absurd.
Well, you know, being the devil's advocate
devil's advocate. We have to take a commercial break before you devil your advocate, okay?
All right.
And you're going to devil me some eggs later. Okay, just
FYI. That's a good idea.
Okay. But I digress. We need to take a really quick break. We're chatting this morning with William Kay. William, are you out of Alberta?
Yeah.
Okay, because Canada's a big place. And I was...
So is Alberta.
I'm thinking, I think I know what town he's in. Okay, he's in Alberta. We'll be right
Alberta's
back.
Alberta's not a town.
Well, no, but at least it's a place. It's not a giant country.
It is. State of mind.
We'll be right back. When they move into your neighborhood, they take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? You never steal. Of course we have a song about that.
Monkey Ball.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us online to send us hate mail after today, probably for goofing off on Easter, at wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with our friend William Kay from Alberta, Canada. And Alberta's a province. That's the word I couldn't find. I could think of county.
Yes.
I could think of state.
We don't have
states
of the Union. We have provinces of the Dominion.
Oh, I could think
of... Alberta has a capital city, which is called Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that is where I am.
Nice. Well, I just was trying to give a better locator than Canada. It's a big place. I forgot about the whole province thing. Even down here, we don't have any uniformity. Like, we have county supervisors, but the guys up north of us in Oregon have county commissioners. So, I don't know. I think everybody's making up their own stuff. So, Devil's Advocate is still sitting here in the studio.
Yes,
Look at Louisiana has parishes instead of counties.
Oh, yeah, see, there
That's
you
right.
go.
Well, just so you know,
we're just doing it
I looked this up. The country of Syria has almost the same land area and population as the state of Florida.
Oh.
Hmm.
Just so you can sort of visualize the whole affair.
Yeah.
Hmm. Kind of bigger
same
than
same population, same land mass.
Formidable
in Florida.
Yeah.
And well, probably around the same sort of heat, too. It's hot there. So.
Yeah.
Well,
so
my devil's advocate position here was, granted, this may not have been a high-tech device dropped from the air and for mass distribution. But Assad is known for, you know, dropping barrel bombs. Why couldn't they have put some canister full of some homemade stuff in a barrel and dropped it in the middle of the street? Would have had the same effect, wouldn't it?
Well, wouldn't dynamite have the same effect?
Well, but I'm saying as far as the chemical agent, you said that it was one canister that was split open. That could have come out of a barrel bomb, couldn't it?
The aircraft that was above it, which the Americans were tracking because the Russians told them it was going to be there, it's an Su-22. It's a fighter bomber. Barrel bombs usually dropped out of helicopters. And it would have to be precise. Like, once again, had this thing gone through the roof of a house or into some pond, nobody would have got killed. But if Assad simply wanted to kill the people in that neighborhood. Had he used dynamite and a barrel bomb, it wouldn't have made any headlines. I mean, that sort of thing happens all the time. He's dropped 1,000 barrel bombs. I don't, view him as a particularly evil guy, but he has been rather ruthless in his prosecution of the civil war, and there's been a lot of collateral damage.
Right.
And, you know, over the years, you know, if Al-Qaeda or the oppositional forces are, you know, fighting out of a civilian area, he has not wavered in terms of sending in, you know, free fall bombs and barrel bombs into those neighborhoods. And there has been a lot of civilian damage, a lot of collateral damage to this. So if he really just wanted to blast them, he would have used that, and it wouldn't have made the news.
So you don't think
Look at the city of Aleppo. It's 2.5 million people. Take some photographs of that. The place has been demolished.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he didn't use any chemical weapons.
Well, why use
chemical weapons here?
Well, you don't think maybe he was kind of testing the waters to see if Trump was going to be the same as Obama and kind of back off and have the same position? You know, let's test this out and see what happens.
That's one theoretical motivation. I strongly question the previous chemical attack that was blamed upon him.
Mm-hmm.
One person who questioned that strongly was the head of the CIA. There's some good articles online as to why Obama ultimately backed down. It was because he was getting some high-level intelligence saying that they had serious reservations as to whether or not Assad was responsible for that chemical attack either. And there's some very good reason to believe that he was not responsible for that. But at the moment of this attack, it was on the eve of a huge conference in Europe about the future of Syria. Syrians and the Russians had been reaching out to the West, to the politicians, to public opinion. They were trying to make nice and give the best possible spin on their own regime. They are, in fact, winning the war on the ground, slowly and brutally, but they are, you know, they've driven them out of Aleppo. They've driven them up into that Idlib province, which is primarily a rural area. So there was, you know, they weren't as though they were in some desperate situation where they had to resort to these sorts of things. And they did it at a time when they were really reaching out to the Trump administration in particular. So using chemical weapons would thwart that whole agenda.
Right.
And that
totally makes sense. I don't argue with that. And I know that the Americans don't have a presence there because of our past policy. The Russians are getting a foothold over there, and it would be nice if something would happen that would get us back into the area, you know, according to the administration. So we could basically run the Russians out. This is a great idea to make everybody have egg on their face, and we come in and be the good guys. Well, I see that. I mean, that
Americans are on the ground in Syria in the very eastern part of the country, near the city of Raqqa.
Mm-hmm.
They have been, Hillary Clinton and Obama have been bankrolling large sections of the Syrian opposition since 2011. They have been there indirectly.
Right.
The people who really want to benefit from this, who are going to benefit from this, are, you know, our old friends in Saudi Arabia, you know, the Gulf Sheikhs, the oil monarchs. They have been determined to bring down that regime for several years now,
sure.
Actually dating far back than that. Trump ran on a campaign that he wasn't going to support regime change in Syria, that he was going to ally with Assad and the Russians, make the primary enemy, ISIS, the Islamic fundamentalists, work with those groups to get rid of the Islamic fundamentalists. And then sort of, you know, he ran on an isolationist campaign.
Yeah,
that he
really
wasn't
did.
Going to come entangled in all these sort of foreign
right.
countries' problems.
Well, by staying out of that,
by
staying out of there, I think, aren't we allowing the Russians and Iran and Syria to kind of monopolize things over there? I mean, if we have any chance of having any kind of influence over there, which I don't know if we should or shouldn't. We should do something to influence a regime change. Because
really?
Assad is not our our friend. He's not a good guy.
Yeah, but who's going to take over behind him? That's
well,
the big thing.
Exactly.
You can't
exactly.
just you kick can't one trust guy out and leave it all.
Bottom line is there's so many players over there. You don't know who is who. And, I mean, every time there's been a regime change over there, it's turned out worse.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, these cities that were modern cities had a regime change. And they're rubble today.
And now they're Stone Age. Well, it's kind of interesting. I don't know if how much you follow the most of our media here is left media. But I was listening to Progressive Radio the other night, for, I don't know, I had a long drive. And so
for over an
hour, I listened to these people craft this amazingly complex web that Trump actually sent people over there who, you know, whether it was chemical or chlorine or, you know, sarin or whatever the gas was, that we did that so that Trump could go bomb Syria so that he could show everybody that he wasn't friends with the Russians because he bombed their ally.
Yeah.
It's like,
That conspiracy theory has been out there. That was coming from some of the mainstream media networks.
Yeah.
I haven't heard the part that actually linked the Trump administration to the initial chemical attack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they did it
but
on purpose.
There were a lot of mainstream journalists who thought that he came down so hard on this just to prove that he wasn't a Putin agent, you know, to somehow
right.
undermine this whole campaign to discredit him as an agent of Russia. He did that. Of course, part of that conspiracy theory is that due to the deconfliction agreements with Russia, the Americans had to notify the Russians they were about to attack that air base that they attacked. So the Russians did have time to get out of there and no doubt told their Syrian allies the same. But about 90 minutes before the actual attack on the Syrian air base by the cruise missiles, the American military telephoned the Russians, told them exactly where they were going to attack, and gave them time to go out there. So that really feeds that conspiracy theory. That,
it does.
It really didn't do the Russians any harm. They got out of there. Nobody got hurt. It's sort of all for show. I don't buy it. It doesn't look like the Russians are buying it either. No, that was a complete game changer.
So where do you see it going? I mean, with recent events, where do you see Russia and Iran? I mean, Iran's been very quiet. North Korea's been very quiet. I think he got somebody's attention, don't you?
Oh, he's got the entire world's attention now.
Oh, yeah.
That was, a very reckless move. He has, you know, the agenda with Hillary and the rest of these people was for regime change in Syria, possible, you know, shooting war with Iran, really downgrading relations with Russia back to a Cold War status. That was where the train was going before Trump got elected.
Right.
And it seems to me that Trump initially tried to turn that thing around. The deep state, he tried to steer it in another direction. But it looks like Trump got turned around, and now the deep state is back on the initial trajectory that it was on, which is regime change in Syria, possible shooting war in North Korea. That's his own little spin. But once again, like really hostile relations with Russia. Putin said, I mean, relations have not been this bad, you know, since the Cold War. And the Russians were so optimistic when Trump got elected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so was I. I mean, I realized this is a real breakthrough. It's a breakthrough for peace because he ran on this campaign of non-intervention. He ran on a campaign of getting along with Russia.
And, you know, it's sad that I agree 100% with that. But then the media turns around and spins it. We're in bed with Russia now. And, you know, he had all these previous deals set up and all. And now we've done a 180. And I don't know. I think we could have done some really good things had we had a little better relation with Russia. Now I don't see that
but
happening.
But does it or did it send a message that we're not just going to sit around and be afraid of our own shadow?
Oh, I think it did.
And maybe.
Because he is
maybe
now.
Maybe that accomplishes something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we've been such.
I think the world is looking at him now
curious.
Like a kind of a hot shot and don't mess around.
We have to take a quick break again, but when we come back,
okay.
I'd be kind of curious, William, what you. Because we don't really talk about foreign policy with you. We typically talk about, you know, the environmental stuff. But I'm kind of curious what you thought of the previous administration's footprint in foreign policy. Because, I don't know, here it was pretty frustrating. But when we come back, I'll be curious about that. Because I feel like I almost came in halfway through the movie. I don't know where you were before this started. So if we could hit that briefly when we return. You are listening to We the People. Bill didn't thank our sponsor, but he'll do that when we come back. You have 2 minutes to figure that out, Bill.
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Get ready.
I'll put it up there.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Hey, we need to thank our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar, for sponsoring this first hour. And
good thing we got to it before the hour was over.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, but the first thing Monday morning, you need to call them and maybe talk to them about getting that pool heated up early. You can put a little solar pack on that thing, heat that pool up, be swimming in the next couple of weeks.
It'd
be pretty
exactly.
sweet. Yeah, Powerhouse Solar can do that for you. Call Bruce or Sue and talk to them about it. Their phone number is 530-275-5600, or you can get them online at powerhousesolar.com. They're out there on Caterpillar Road, and they'll do a really good job for you. Powerhouse Solar.
There you have it.
There you are.
Nice job, Bill.
Hey, thanks.
Okay. so what were we talking? Oh, yeah. Hey, William, what did you think of the Obama administration's foreign policy that was always kind of like, oh, if you do that again, we're going to do nothing? I mean, they had all these fake red lines.
They destroyed Libya.
Yes, they did.
Before I get into that, you're talking to a Canadian. I'm not actually an American.
I know. That's what's fun about it.
So I've got to explain something.
Oh, okay.
After World War II, the British, Canadian, and Australian and American governments signed a whole series of treaties, over 100 of them, that closely integrated the militaries of these countries. It wasn't just NATO, NORAD. There was a whole bunch of other deals and treaties dealing with, you know, weapon standardization and a common foreign policy. But there wasn't a lot of public discussion about these. Anyways, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy got on the telephone and he called the Canadian Prime Minister, who was a man by the name of John Diefenbaker. And he told Prime Minister Diefenbaker, I want you to put your military on the highest level of alert. It looks like this might actually turn into a war. And Diefenbaker said, well, you know, this is Canada. We really don't have this whole commander-in-chief phenomenon. I'm going to have to talk to Parliament. And Kennedy just told him, just do it. Do what I said. Diefenbaker hangs up the phone. He calls his defense minister. And he explains what just happened. And the defense minister says, well, just do it. Do what he said. And then Diefenbaker says, well, I'm not going to do this on my own. I'm at least going to have a cabinet meeting. So he summons all the cabinet members, not the whole parliament, just the cabinet, to discuss whether or not they're going to follow these instructions. When the defense minister hears that Diefenbaker is doing this, he's frustrated, so he calls the head of the Canadian Armed Forces, and he tells him behind Diefenbaker's back, put yourself on high alert. The head of the Canadian Armed Forces said, we already are. They got their orders directly from the Pentagon.
Oh, wow.
And all this political BS was window dressing. Mm-hmm. We are deeply integrated into the American military system here. There is a deep state in Canada as well. We've broken the rule, like under the Kretschmann administration, we did not participate in the Iraq war, although you notice the Australians and the British, these other countries, they always send token forces along with it. We did participate in a lot of the other foreign adventures of the American government. So we are pretty much locked into this system.
But wasn't that part of
his credit?
Wasn't that part of the NATO agreement?
There's NATO. There's a whole series called the Anglo-American Treaties. There's another one called NORAD, the North American Air Defense Agreements. There's a whole series of sort of military alliances and treaties that really tightly integrate. Like not all NATO countries went to Iraq for sure.
Right.
I think Spain did. countries can opt out of these things. Whereas there are certain sort of treaties where Canada cannot opt out of them. And the whole Cuban Missile Crisis sort of, told Canadians that there are certain things that happen in the Pentagon which are almost completely out of any electoral control. So we're sort of stuck into this system, although there are exceptions to the rule. I noticed that with this recent chemical attack, Canada's prime minister, which is, stuck his head out of the parapet and said that he's not convinced who's responsible for this chemical strike in Syria, which is rather unusual, but it's interesting to get that on the record. As for my general opinion about the whole Obama administration, no, I thought he was a pretty aggressive foreign policy guy. This whole covert war in Syria, him and Hillary and the whole gang, they're responsible for this. That war would not be going on. I don't know if you read Jane's Defense Weekly and some of these military publications. Someone leaked a shipping manifest to Jane's Defense Weekly regarding ammunition being shipped to the Syrian opposition. This is during the Obama administration, and this is one shipment, and it contained 98 cargo containers of ammunition. Those containers they put on the ships?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
98 of those full of ammunition. That was one shipment going from the American government to the Syrian opposition. That was 3 or 4 years ago. They have been channeling huge amounts of money and weapons into that opposition. They have been there, and it isn't as though he was some sort of pacifist. Hillary and Obama have got blood on their hands all the way up to their elbows. My main sort of hobby horse regarding sort of the foreign policy stuff is we really need to think about who our enemies and our allies are. I'm someone who has a very negative view or dim view of the oil monarchies, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi and these sorts of countries. I think those are very regressive places. They are serious sponsors of state terrorism. They are sort of Islamic imperialists. They have a profound and unwarranted influence in the policies of our governments and our culture as well.
And they also have a total unwillingness to participate in their own defense, which really, I don't understand why we put up with that.
Well, if we got schmoes that are going to do it for free, I guess why bother?
Exactly. that's exactly right. I mean, they have the most to lose by letting this all get out of control, and yet they sit back and, I mean, they don't even throw a lot of money at it. They just let the Americans get in there and get their hands dirty, or the British or whoever else wants to come in. NATO, they kind of sit back and go, I don't know, but these folks have the most to lose and participate the least, I think, in their own area. And I mean, how do you fix that?
Well, we have to really reexamine who our allies are and who our enemies are. I would put those groups on the enemy list, and Trump, during the campaign, he did make a bunch of hostile comments regarding, Saudi Arabia, a sponsor of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like he's been turned around on that. And also, the European Union, once again, I don't think we'll ever, hopefully never get in sort of a shooting war with them, but they've got their own agenda. And we certainly see it loud and clear in the whole climate thing. That they were quite willing to undermine the economies of a lot of other countries in the world to save themselves. So if we need something of a diplomatic revolution where we will sort of re-investigate who our friends are and who our enemies are, and then what the Americans have got, one of the big problems is, of course, just the military-industrial complex. I think that America probably spends, you know, vastly more than they need to on their own defense. If it was just a matter of really defending the country, they would not need anywhere near that kind of military outlays.
No, it's if okay they stay out of other countries, they don't.
Weaponry.
Yeah, I say if they stay out of all these other countries, they don't need that much.
Exactly.
But, yeah, but we have to go over and be the world police.
His estimate was 68 countries in the world right now can call upon the Americans for defense. I mean, they've entangled themselves with that many different countries. You know,
right.
if Montenegro gets invaded, you know, we could set up World War III. And John McCain was just, you know, apoplectic because he wasn't getting enough support in the Senate to get Montenegro into NATO. And there's all these countries now that can rely on the Americans for defense. Trump ran on a campaign of disentanglement, of non-intervention. You know, George Washington preached about that, like, don't get involved in old Europe's wars, all these, you know, dynastic struggles and what have you. But it seems to me that, you know, Eisenhower wasn't, you know, whistling Dixie when he warned about the military-industrial complex. It is a very powerful lobby. They like the fact that America is, you know, integrated into all these problem spots around the world. And that is something that really, that's the core part of the deep state. And that's something that a lot of people, myself included, thought that Trump was going to resist.
Yeah, that's a pretty tall order at times.
We got to take a break, but let's talk about what happens if we do pull out of those areas. What kind of a vacuum do we create?
Were you reading my mind?
Yeah, I was. I was right there.
Still focusing on the devil thing.
Free rent right there for a minute.
Bill's taking out rent in my head. We'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Always the trick.
Yeah, find out who your friends are.
Who actually are your friends.
Yeah, we don't know.
It's a shifting target over there.
It is. They're your friends today, but then you're shooting at them tomorrow.
Yeah, but you don't know who they are. I mean, all these guys
I know it. That's the big problem. You don't know who's who. And so William, what happens? Okay, so we decide, you know what? We need to get our mitts out of everybody else's business and let them sell it themselves. I think, wouldn't that create like this huge void for obviously our enemies to move in and take over and basically start doing the same thing we're doing, which worked out really well for Russia and Afghanistan. They decided to, you know, that they got beat on pretty hard over there and they pulled out and left it to us. And now, you know, we're in the same shape. But what do you do? I mean, do you create the void?
Well, to some extent, I think America is making enemies where they need not, by getting involved in those countries. I look at the Arab world, and it seems to me that it's sort of locked in this long-term Republican versus monarchist struggle that America had during the revolution, that, you know, the English had during the English Civil War. It's happened in many places where you've got monarchies, and then there's an effort to overthrow them. Of course, the forces that are trying to overthrow the monarchies are not always really nice, progressive, you know, democratic type people. And you get some pretty harsh regimes trying to overthrow the monarchs. But that's what the Arab world is locked into. You go back to, say, 1950s. So there's some kids screaming in the hallway here.
I'm like, hey, are you running the daycare on the side?
All of those countries are monarchs. Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Libya. These are all absolute monarchies, much in the same manner that, Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi are now. There was a Republican uprising across the entire Arab world, and some countries became republics. But the sad fact was that many of the countries that became republics ended up with these sort of one-family tyrannies that looked a lot right. like monarchies. Like you had Assad, the Assad dynasty in Syria. You had Gaddafi in Libya. They weren't a heck of a lot better.
Yeah, they weren't democratic republics.
They were highly dictatorial.
Right.
But still, they were republics, and they tended to be a lot more democratic than Saudi Arabia. They tended to be a lot more secular and not quite as militantly Islamicist as the monarchies were. But across the Arab world, if you sort of just leave aside all the fake boundaries that the British and the French drew, there's this, long-term struggle between the Republican movement and the monarchist movement. And what the monarchists are trying to do is annihilate every Republican government. And they did it in Iraq, absolute disaster to the people. They did it in Libya, same thing. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to do it in Syria. And, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Paine, spinning in their graves that America would go to the Middle East and prop up these monarchs. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Kuwait was traditionally part of that country. To prop up the Emir of Kuwait again, and in all the after World War II, initially a lot of these monarchs were propped up by the British Empire. After World War II, the Americans stepped into the British boots. And they've been propping up these monarchs ever since.
No, you're absolutely right. We've got to take a break here at the top of the hour, but let's get right back on that and talk about what happens when we try to influence and put in a democratic republic in an area that's never had one.
And doesn't want it.
And doesn't
want it. At the end of the day, they don't know how to run it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we'll be back.
You have been listening to We the People. We will be back for another hour with our guest, William Kay, out of Alberta, Canada. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon. You're joining the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
What's up? I'm Bob Martin.
And we're here on Easter afternoon. Lovely. With our impromptu guest, Mr. William Kay, who is out of the province, now that I've gotten my word province back.
Yeah.
Province of Alberta, Canada. But, Bill's got the commercial, bro.
Oh, yeah.
Look at you guys. Look at you guys. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Powerhouse Solar, our sponsor for this hour. Powerhouse Solar will do anything you want solar. They can do it. I don't care if it's cutting your energy bill, heating up your swimming pool.
And Lord knows, when you live in Reading and you're only 2 miles from the sun.
That's right.
Cutting the energy bill in the summer is a big deal.
Gosh, yes. We had like...
Well, we used to be 2 miles from the sun.
Yeah.
Are we closer now?
I don't know. I haven't seen enough sun in the last 6 months to give you a definite answer.
Well, let me check with... I'll check with Bruce and Sue on that, and they can give us a read on what they're getting on those solar panels, because I think they'd be the people to know.
Yeah, they would.
So, yeah, Powerhouse Solar.
Well,
call them at 530-275-5600 or get them on the web at powerhousesolar.com. Yeah, they can do anything for you, solar, and they're great folks.
And that's all they do.
So that's all they do. They've been around a long time.
I don't know what other people do that are doing solar, but it kind of makes it sound like maybe they're doing dog grooming or something on the side. I'm not sure what that's all about.
Yeah, I don't know, but I see these guys everywhere.
They are everywhere.
They are busy.
Nice.
Yeah, so there you have it.
Yeah, because as we head into summer, there's nothing funny about our sun exposure around here. It's very serious.
Oh, but it's a great opportunity to bank your solar power for the
no kidding. Well,
months ahead.
I mean, at our old house, all joking aside, because it wasn't funny, our power bill in the summer was $800.
Yeah, our neighbor's was $900
that air every
conditioner.
Month.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah, it was horrible.
How hot's it get up where you are, William?
What was that?
What does Alberta do in the summer? Does it get hot?
Yeah. These prairie cities are the nicest place in the world in the summertime.
Huh? Like what's your like top temperature in the summer? What's normal?
Well, we're Celsius here. We're not Fahrenheit, but it would be the equivalent. I've seen it go, you know, like 105 to 110 Fahrenheit, but that's pretty unusual. What you get a lot of are, you know, strings of, you know, 2 weeks at a time where it's 80 to 90 and you can't find a cloud. You're in the middle of a sapphire dome.
Oh, hold on now.
That's kind of nice.
Are you telling me you don't even have chemtrails or anything up there? Come on.
Chemtrails. Oh. Yeah. Well, only when John McCain flies over. Yeah.
Good one. Oh my gosh. So what do you think, you know, with all of this, you know, now obviously we've sent a totally different signal to the world with our foreign policy than, you know, than was talked about on the campaign trail. So we've kind of established that part. So back into your wheelhouse, what do you think that does for all this environmental overreach with the global warming and all that stuff?
Well, the danger is if Trump is so willing to throw half his constituency under the bus because he saw a photograph on TV, allegedly, there's a real danger that he's going to throw the other half of his constituency, the domestic constituency, under the bus, so that he's going to abandon his commitment to you know, environmental law reform. It does not look like he's going to do that. There was some kerfluffle. He issued an executive order recently, a number of them dealing with the environment, and he did not explicitly denounce the endangerment finding, which had been underpinning the EPA's efforts to police carbon dioxide emissions. And people were hoping he would issue stronger language than that. There may be legal reasons for that, but it seems like he's got a pretty good team of climate skeptics in there, and they're going to march forward with this. They're going to get America out of the Paris agreements. They are going to dramatically downsize the EPA. They are going to end the war on coal, hopefully. But, you know, the same sort of forces that were working on Trump on the foreign policy front are grinding away on him on the domestic front. So the worrisome part is we might see, you know, another 180-degree turn. And we end up with, you know, the uniparty. You know, it's basically Hillary Clinton all over again. That's a real fear now, because that was such a stark reversal of his stated promises and policies.
Right, and he's kind of angling in the direction of reform right now with some of the EPA stuff he's done and he's done a lot with air quality, but with coal and whatnot. He's sending some signals that he's going to maybe do some reform.
Well, he's calling for a 31% reduction in the EPA budget, which is a start.
Right.
He's calling for a review, which they're going to, you know, because the environmentalists are so far ahead of the game. They sort of integrate their agenda through, you know, dozens of different bureaucracies.
They own the game.
Yes.
They're trying to cull all these bureaucracies now and find out exactly if we really wanted to cut climate out of the U.S. federal government, where would that happen? Like there's the National Association of Ocean, Air and Oceanography, it's NASA, and it's, you know, the National Science Foundation, it's the EPA, it's a lot of other government bureaucracies have got these little climate departments.
Well, they stopped,
that have been working away on this agenda.
Well, they stopped the one BLM regulation that was going to shift. Gosh, I don't have that at my fingertips. But it was going to shift the BLM focus from land management to something that had to do with all this climate stuff. And that is...
Oh, the waters of the U.S.
That is really terrible reporting on my part.
Waters of the U.S., that's another one.
Yeah.
That was a different one.
So he's issued a lot of what appear to be positive stuff, you know, whether he can get it through Congress. And, like, people like Scott Pruitt and Perry and Zinke, he's got a lot of people in there who have a history of making very enviro-skeptical, climate-skeptical statements. So far... there's really no grounds to believe that he's about to do a major reversal on this. However, the whole climate thing, a lot of this environmental stuff, is integrated into the foreign affairs stuff. Because there's a lot of foreign countries, particularly the European Union, who are really going to be unhappy if the Americans make a decisive break from the whole climate agenda.
Oh, we've talked about that. They're totally invested in that, and they can't, I mean, for them to do a reversal would be disastrous at this point, wouldn't it?
Yes. That they'll be, you know, cutting off one of the legs of the chair they're sitting on. But then they don't have the fossil fuel reserves that we have in North America. It sort of makes sense for them. But, you know, like we all, America's got a military industrial complex. Europe has got an ecological industrial complex. It's a major employer, like millions with an S on the end of people who are employed in one level or another of their whole green industry structure in Europe. So it has a, you know, it's too big to die sort of thing. Yeah, they've got that going on. But if he, you know, if it's the whole reason why he returned to sort of the Democratic Party agenda on foreign policy was to sort of, you know, appease the deep state, then he might do it for the same reasons. I mean, it's the path of least resistance for him is to sort of go with the flow, you know, stay in the Paris Agreement, at least give lip service to these sorts of things, perhaps pay less but pay a little, you know, try to make it appear as though he's, you know, pulling back but letting things sort of roll ahead. That's the danger. I was someone who was, you know, thrilled when he got elected. I thought it was a major breakthrough. But circa April the 7th, that suddenly changed for me and for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen, well, in the past, all the past presidents, as far as using the Congressional Review Act to roll back regulation, George Bush rolled back one. Now, when you look at the volume of regulation, there were like some 600 major regulations,
right,
with an economic impact estimated at about $740 billion. So far, he has rolled back 11 of those and at this point, and has two in the hopper, and he has until the end of the month to utilize that. And that doesn't require congressional approval.
But also, he said for every new regulation, you have to get rid of three. Wasn't that something else he
two
did?
Two or three.
I remember hearing
that.
Something about that.
Yeah.
That if Congress wants to impose a regulation in one spot, they've got to reduce something elsewhere.
Well, right. See, that's the thing. Congress doesn't impose the regulation. That's where it becomes incredibly important.
It's the bureaucracy.
Right, because Congress makes the laws, and then the bureaucrats figure out how to make the law, you know, hit the ground.
Applicable,
you know. So they figure out how it's going to roll out. But the bad part has been, over the last 8 years, you know, whether Congress makes a law or not, the bureaucracy is kind of running away. And if you don't have a president who keeps that in check, you're in big trouble.
Well, it's this whole issue of the deep state.
Right.
That within the government, there are these entrenched bureaucrats who make very high salaries, who on a daily basis interact with people, you know, in big business and in academia, and who have great contempt for the electorate. And they think that they know better, and they are resistant to change. And there's a long history, certainly in Canada, you know, our cabinet members have to be elected members. So, like, our cabinet members in the federal government would also have to be congressmen. Hmm. And quite often these people are not well-versed in bureaucracy. And the senior bureaucrats, the deep state, have got a science down. You know, they get a new cabinet minister. On the first day they show up and they drop off, you know, 10,000 pages of regulations that he's got to read and understand in order so that he can be the minister of corrections or whatever.
Oh.
And typically cabinet ministers don't hold the job for very long. So by the time these guys start figuring out exactly what's going on within this department, they're replaced.
Do they have
And you know, you end up with this sort of this deep state that's really running the government, that's interacting with the media. It's a very non-democratic sort of system.
It's kind of interesting because we wind up with that here, especially in states like California that have term limits, because the bureaucrats spend their entire career there.
Yes.
But the elected people are in and out in now 12 years, which seems like a very long time, but there's so much to figure out. And by the time you get halfway good at it, you're on your way, you know, you're on the backside of that term, and the other guys are still there for another 20 years. How about this?
And there's a lack of transparency. You know, it's like pulling teeth. Like, we always have to sue the government to get information out of them.
We have that sometimes. And a lot of times we just don't, if the executive branch really isn't super responsive to the people, like here in California, they have a super majority. So the Democrats have a super majority. They can do basically whatever they want. There's no way for the Republican side or the independents, if there are any, I don't know of any, but they don't have the ability to slow them down. So they wind up kind of runaway train. And the only way people have the ability to stop them is by putting initiatives on the ballot. However,
yeah, but can't the new department heads that are appointed by the president move into
at the
these
federal level.
At the federal level, move in and start reassigning these folks and getting them out of there?
Yeah, they can start doing a lot of that. And that's always the big fear.
That's what they're going to have to
do. You get a big regime change like Trump rolls into town, and that's why they want to slow down the cabinet appointments and all that. That's the whole point.
Right.
That's also why they put a moratorium on the different bureaucracies communicating with the media and that sort of thing, because they didn't want a disinformation campaign going on while they were trying to get the heads of these departments in place, all the cabinet members.
Right.
It's a tricky deal. We've got
I
to
think
take
a lot
a really
of this is going to end up in the United States in front of the Supreme Court. It seems to me that a lot
some will.
These people are being appointed cabinet members. I mean, there's like Pruitt in charge of the EPA.
Yes.
And people are saying, no, you don't have the right to dramatically cut back on your staff. Legal precedents in place where you must administer this regulation the way it is currently stated. Yeah. And then, you know, there were all these sort of, with the EPA, under the previous administrations, there was this whole business of sue and settle. The EPA would collude with an environmental group like, you know, Natural Resources Defense Council or Sierra Club. The Sierra Club would sue the EPA and say that you're not doing your job. You know, this regulation specifies that you clean up this lake. You know, you prevent this dam from being built, what have you. And the EPA would pretend to be defending the suit, but then the two parties would agree to a settlement outside of court, and a judge would rubber stamp that. The judgment would then serve as a pretext for the EPA to expand its authority. And they did this on hundreds of occasions, and it was a mechanism whereby the EPA greatly expanded its authority.
Yes.
With this endangerment finding, you know, where the EPA is supposed to suppress a carbon dioxide, they've got a judge's decision. Not only first, you know, they got a Supreme Court decision saying that the EPA could police carbon dioxide. Then the EPA came out with its endangerment finding. That went to court because an environmental group sued the EPA saying they weren't doing enough to, you know, suppress CO2 emissions. Then they got a judgment from a D.C. court saying that, yeah, you must do more to do this. So the debate is, can Pruitt right now, in his current capacity, say, no, I am not going to enforce that regulation, or does he have the capacity just to veto that regulation? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, see, at the end
I think a lot of those questions are going to go all the way to the Supreme Court.
Probably, but at the end of the day, if there is still a law in place that requires that regulation be carried out, he doesn't have the ability to change law, although in the past, I mean, I say that kind of laughing up my sleeve because in the last 8 years they did that a lot. We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about this. Because
let's talk about the difference between a law and a regulation, because a regulation, say, can change.
Right, as long as it doesn't de facto change the law, huh?
Yeah. Damn.
Tricky stuff. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People Radio.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my
give a damn for sale.
Welcome back. Having a little fun in the chat room, finally. The chat room's working today. Ta-da! So if you listen live, we are live Sundays from noon to 2. And, of course, any other time, you can catch us on the commercial-free archive, wethepeopleradio.us. And if these are topics your friends are interested in, friends or family or whatever, shoot it to them on Facebook or Twitter. And if you read things or listen to people and you think, gosh, I'd like to hear more from that person, please send that to us. Our email addresses and phone numbers are right there on the website, wethepeopleradio.us.
There you have it.
Ta-da! Little internal commercial there. Because I was just thinking about how much fun it would be to, we need to widen our net. We need to capture some more ideas. Okay, William, during the break we were talking about the idea of laws versus regulation and how all this environmental stuff will roll out. So we've seen it go one of two ways. I know with the VA, there's a good example there. Congress passed a law allowing veterans to utilize outside care outside the Veterans Administration, under a set of parameters and whatnot. But the Veterans Administration was responsible for rolling out the regulation that made that happen, right? Hiring the provider that would do that, figuring out how the whole program would be administered. Well, interestingly enough, they didn't want that, really. It was there to kind of press them on the wait times that were happening for appointments and whatnot. So the VA, this was, 4 years ago or so, said, we're not happy being pressured for this, so we're going to find somebody who's ill-equipped to roll this program out. They needed 3,000 employees, roughly, to make it happen. They were down to 300. So the guys they hired were wildly understaffed, and the whole thing was like sending a car off the assembly line with square wheels. So it can go both ways. I mean, on the one hand, the bureaucracy or the deep state can, regulate the heck out of everything, or they can purposely fumble the ball and frustrate the law from going into effect.
Well, the issue, I think, facing America right now, which we were talking about before the ad, was how easy is it to get rid of regulations? I mean, is it simply a matter for the head of the bureaucracy to say, okay, delete that? If there's been judgments already granted from courts compelling that particular ministry to go forward. I'm just going through the EPA website, and they give you the three steps of the regulation, but it stops with the codification. There's no, what do you do to get rid of this regulation? They don't even think about that. I mean, once we got them, they're part of the Constitution as far as they're concerned. I'll tell you where it's a huge issue is in the United States, the Antiquities Act.
Yes.
Oh, that's horrible.
Where they create these massive parks.
Yep.
And almost every president does these sort of, midnight declarations as they're going out the door, and they create these humongous parks.
The monuments.
Where there's going to be no mining, settling, what have you. Obama did it in Utah, over a million acres, called the Bear's Ears National Monument. They all do this. He did another one in Alaska.
They did one.
As soon as Trump got there, everybody was saying, well, why doesn't he just rescind it? I mean,
it's kind of interesting with that. That is actually something that's in my wheelhouse a little bit. So anything that is created as a national monument already was public land, either managed by Fish or BLM or Forest Service. So they don't take private property to do that. But once you turn it into a monument, your utilization, any minerals that are extracted, all those things, the utilization changes dramatically, and is heavily, heavily restricted. So most people really hate it when that comes to a public land, mass near them, which is
the
horrible.
The legal question is,
but you can't just,
why cannot another president just undo that?
It's,
and throw the open area for a resource development. It's never happened.
Right. They're working on it. They're not. It's funny because the Antiquities Act shows, and it's really, I think, a misuse of the Antiquities Act, but it's easy to tie it up as a monument, but just reversing it is kind of it's an unknown quantity at this point. Does it need legislation?
How could it be any more difficult to reverse it? I mean, if it just was a stroke of a pen to put it in.
Because constitutionally, there's nothing in there to take it out. It was only to put in, which is a bad answer. But
no, I don't think the word constitution is right there. I mean, basically, if you're allowing one president to do that,
right,
and no other president can undo it, then he's changing the constitution.
It doesn't really say
he doesn't
no
have
other
the right for all time in the future. And this is the argument that I would make to the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Is the one, this is an act of the president. This isn't an act of the whole Congress to, you know, if he's saying, okay, no one's ever going to drill for oil in northern Alaska again, like the,
right,
sort of all perpetuity. I don't see how any president, elected president, has the authority to do that. For all times, no one's ever going to mine in Utah again.
Yes, and I don't know. They
that seems unconstitutional that a president would have those powers. It seems to be in keeping with the Constitution that another president elected later could reverse that decision.
Yeah, you would think. They just haven't done it. That's the trick, is it hasn't been.
That's the old.
It's not that
we've never done it that way before.
Which isn't to say that they won't.
No.
Again.
Well, they absolutely should. There's some absolute treasures of coal and oil that are being stuck inside these monuments that would be a great benefit to the American economy.
Well, California has natural resources greater than some countries in the Middle East, but we can't touch them. It's crazy because we do have the technology to do it safely and reap the benefits, but it's fossil fuels. And, boy, that's like the big no-no anymore. We've got to kind of change our thinking on that because we can burn fossil fuels in a clean manner.
Right. Yeah, of course we can.
Yeah.
Well, I'm firmly in the camp that CO2 emissions are good for the atmosphere. They're good for plant life. They are having a negligible effect on the temperature, and that a slightly warming planet is much preferable to a cooling planet. I do not for one New York second think that human emissions of CO2 are a bad thing.
No. And, you know, we always go through with that same example about the CO2, you know, the ambient CO2 in any given space is about 400 parts per million. But if you...
That's outdoors, yeah.
Right. But if you perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on someone, you breathe into them 40,000 parts per million.
Yeah, but Leonardo DiCaprio will disagree with that. And he's really a smart guy.
He's like a scientist, only different.
No one's saying that the higher CO2 levels are causing people to suffocate people. They're simply saying they're trapping heat bouncing off the Earth. Like, yeah, certainly in a submarine or an elevator, CO2 levels are vastly higher than they are outdoors. Like, you know, 20, 30 times higher. But even that is of no harm to human health. But the global warming argument isn't that we're, you know, somehow denying ourselves oxygen. They're saying that these trace amounts of CO2 in the atmosphere are trapping heat, and this is, you know, frying the planet. And for that, there is no compelling evidence.
No. But don't all scientists, 98% of them, agree that that's
the figure they kick around is 97%.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's been four different studies they've done, and somehow they've all miraculously come to the same number, 97%.
Isn't that awesome?
You can go online. Each one of those studies has been thoroughly debunked. One of them was a survey of 10,000 scientists. Only 3,000 responded. Half of them did not believe in catastrophic global warming. So they winnowed the number down just to those who were professional climatologists, just to the ones that were actually on the gravy train. We're only going to pay attention to them.
Right.
And they got the 97% figure. Another study, they just read abstracts from 1,000 different climatology papers. But the question they were looking for was not catastrophic, you know, human-caused global warming. The issue was simply, are human emissions having some effect on the weather? And they came once again miraculously to the 97% figure. There's been four different ways that the global warmers have somehow always end up with this 97% consensus figure. You can go online. I can find you petitions signed by over 25,000 scientists who categorically deny the catastrophic human-caused global warming hypothesis. There's been petition after petition signed by that. There is no consensus. What you have is a manufactured consensus where billions of dollars of government money spent in Europe and the United States have mobilized this army of guys in white lab jackets who are preachers of the global warming doctrine, and they managed to dominate one small branch of science. But their hypothesis is absurd, and the bloom is off the rose.
Although, I guarantee you, at any town hall across the country, we'll have a whole host of screaming memes who will be lecturing us on 97% again. We need to take a really quick break.
You'll hear that number over and over again.
I know.
It's another bogus factoid from those people.
It's just frustrating.
Well,
we need to take a really quick
break. The EPA director is a skeptic, and that's the good news.
That is, and that's, I think, going to be helpful. We'll be right back. We need to take a quick break. We're on with our guest, William Kay, out of Alberta, Canada, and we'll be rejoining you here in just a couple minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Didn't he invent rap, Bob? MC Hammer?
Oh, he was one of the early pioneers, practitioners, yes.
Practitioners, thank you.
You could actually understand him and nobody got hurt.
I think the Sugar Hill Gang is widely credited with inventing modern-day rap.
Well, there you go.
Or, introducing it on a mass appeal scale. Well,
see, you never thought you'd get rap trivia here on We the People Radio. Yeah, we are well versed.
I thought it was the Capitol Hill Gang singing "Don't Touch This."
Yeah, there you go.
New wilderness legislation.
New wilderness legislation. So William, as far as environmental policy goes, and the new Trump guys. Okay, so EPA rollback, that's going to be super important, that needs to keep happening.
It's a start. They could actually shut down like 99% of that bureaucracy and America would be better off.
Well, no kidding. I mean, not every state actually has their own EPA, but bunches do. So we're all, those of us living in states with our own EPA just get hammered twice.
Mm-hmm. All you really need is a federal bureaucracy that sort of coordinates local EPAs, and all they really should concern themselves with is air and water quality that people are actually drinking and breathing. I could see the reason for that.
Sure.
You know, we had the famous Lodgepole blowout in Alberta about 20 years ago where they were drilling for oil and they hit a sulfur gas deposit. And killed the riggers, and then this cloud of sulfur gas floated across the province. It's good to have, some sort of warning system that could alert people to that. But that's all you need. A very small team of technicians that are periodically checking the air and the water, make sure no one's being poisoned. But 17,000 bureaucrats, you don't need that. Federally, you just need a small team that's coordinating local efforts.
Yeah, and
all
you
they're
see that,
doing is suppressing economic activity.
Yeah, and you see that a lot where you have an incident, and so we have to develop an entire body of another department of government to regulate because we had one accident.
Well, you know, I mean, of course, there's a huge outcry now that there's any sort of, you know, EPA rollback being even discussed. I mean, now we're going to be like China.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you get rid of one rule and all of a sudden we're all going to...
People are freaking out. Oh, yeah, we're going to... the you know, the environmental community is freaking out. We're going to be like China here any day.
Well, 31% of 17,000, you know, that's over 5,000 people are going to get walking papers. I can see why the environmental movement's freaking out. That sort of thing should be replicated. So many of them now, you know, it was a social movement, but so many of them have migrated into government.
Yes.
It has embedded itself deeply in the government and is now, whew.
And vice versa.
You know, in the universities and what have you, there's, you know, tens upon tens of thousands of professional environmentalists.
Well, and you look at the, you know, Sierra Club and Defenders of Wildlife and all these guys that are supposed to be advocacy organizations, but they are funded in large part by government money.
They get government money and they get big green money. A lot of these wealthy philanthropic organizations, you know, the Rockefeller Brothers and the Pew family and the MacArthur Foundation also pump, you know, probably. There's a, go on, online, there's a group called the Environmental Grant Makers Association, and that's a sampling. It's not the full amount of money moving from big philanthropists into the NGO community, but that's probably $2 billion a year. But you are right. Like, it's like any social movement. It could be started in the private sector, but gradually it migrates into the public sector. The more it gains political influence, the more it can tap various bureaucracies at various levels, and they're very successful at doing that. You know, there's like the Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Park Service and the Forest Service and all these other bureaucracies that the NGOs have tapped into and get grants from.
Mm-hmm.
But they've integrated themselves into sort of a solid organizational complex. And they've done this in other countries as well. They were at one point, you know, a social movement far more on the margins, even though they were elite sponsored. It was very wealthy people at the nucleus of it. Over the last 40 or 50 years, they have deeply embedded themselves into governments at all levels and particularly into the university structure. So they are now almost a parallel government.
Yeah, which was really a smart move because it's working out very well for them. We've got a caller with a question. We got Billy Bob on the line. Hey, what's going on?
Hey, are you there?
Yes, we're here. You're loud and clear, buddy. What's happening?
All right. Great show, Bill and Aaron. You guys do a wonderful job. I listen to you every weekend. And listen, the prompted my call was that why does it take, and my compliments and hats off to you, William, how does it take a Canadian to be so much smarter than 80 or 85% of Americans? I mean, this is unbelievable how much William knows and his expertise. And I just wanted to call and thank him for his attention to our matters. And we're going to bring him in here as a senator of Ontario. Okay, buddy, I'll let you go.
Thanks,
Billy Bob.
Well, it's true, though.
William, you're making Canadians proud.
Okay. Well, maybe it helps to be sort of a bit of an outsider. I find, you know, people have a hard time, you know, criticizing your own government or looking at your own government. You don't want to come across as being unpatriotic. It might help to be sort of slightly out of the picture to really look at things.
Yeah.
It's really helpful because you get a different, you get a very different look at it. You know, you're not bombarded with it all day, every day. And you get a different, you know, different sources. I'd be really excited to post, on the page for today if you would send me what you know, some of the things you use for research. Some of the places that you go to find things and you find their information is pretty truthful. I'm always being asked, who's actually telling the truth? No one's ever 100% right, but I'd love to know some of your guys that you actually trust.
Yeah, okay. It could be a long list. I do a lot of reading, and, you know, the key is, that's the key, and sort of triangulate, and over time you sort of develop your own sort of bullshit detector, you know, you sort of know what's true and what isn't almost at first glance. But about the Canadian Senate, just to go, you guys, you don't have it so bad down there. In Canada, our Senate is not elected. We have
really?
A Senate that's actually appointed and appointed for life.
Oh, how many?
Canada is a monarchy,
really?
Okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, our head of state, even though, you know, in reality, our head of state is the prime minister. In law, our head of state is the governor general, who is a direct appointee of the Queen of England.
You know, that brings up a...
We have two houses of parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Senate, and the Senate in Canada is not elected. Just like in Britain, they've got a House of Lords,
right.
Unelected. They keep reducing its power. Like now, all it can do is sort of tie up legislations for a few years. But there's been a movement
just
in Canada, you know, as long as I can remember. Why don't we have an elected Senate? You know, why don't we have an elected president instead of a governor general? We're still stuck. We're stuck in the, you know, the 14th century here.
Well, why? I got a question. Why, if you were a
territory, take a break while Bill gets his new lips calibrated.
Yeah, well, you were a territory of England at one time. Why is French the second language in Canada?
Well, because what was called Lower Canada or Quebec was a French colony during the Seven Years' War. At the Plains of Abraham, outside of Montreal, the British, under General Wolfe, defeated the French General Montcalm.
Huh.
Both generals dying in combat.
Oh, dear.
But the British prevailed, and part of the saw-off deal was it would be a union of the two peoples.
Okay.
So we've never really gotten away from that, and when, you know, the devil himself, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister... he made bilingualism a constitutional provision when
Ew.
We repatriated the Constitution.
Yeah.
So now, you go to British Columbia, which is the province to the west, like, you know, to, you know, north of Washington State. The French language is the eighth most common language spoken amongst the people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chinese is more spoken. Filipino is more spoken. There are no French people. Once you go west of Toronto, there's no French people at all. But
really?
Every province has to have all these bilingual programs.
Yeah.
All the laws are written in French and English. It's an endless source of irritation to non-French people. and you cannot, you know, be a prime minister in this country unless you're fluently French, which means we endlessly have these Quebecois prime ministers. And as been pointed out, you can only rise so high in the federal civil service. If you're unilingual, you've got to be bilingual. But nobody outside of Quebec speaks French.
Yeah.
So it's
kind of hit a nerve there.
Oh, tell me about it. It's almost there's this French conspiracy to take over Canada. That's what you touch. It's called the Laurentians.
Yeah.
They live along the Gulf of St. Lawrence. But it's a really touchy issue in Canada because there's absolutely no point for places like Alberta to have bilingualist, you know, government policies. Nobody speaks French here. Nobody.
Huh.
More people speak German in this province. More people speak Ukrainian than French in this province.
Oh, my God. Well, that's pretty bad.
Well, I won't mention
that. I had to change the name of the show because we were saying, you know, a Canadian view of U.S. foreign policy. So I just changed it to a Canadian view of stuff in the U.S. we've been, like, all over the place with this. Our show has no topic, which is really fun. I like it. We've got to take a really swift break. And just a program note that the word that starts with B and ends with T can't be said on the air. So Bob had to do some quick push the secret button. And
is he that fast?
Oh,
yes,
he's
it
quick.
Was unbelievable. He was like cat quick.
Boom!
We've never
when we get back, I'm going to test him.
We've never seen it happen before. We don't know. We don't even know what it sounded like. It sounded like pshh, like that. So. I don't know. It's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd explain what that weird noise was that other people heard.
Now, if you're listening later on the replay archives. On the website in the archives. You can hear what he said.
Oh, it doesn't make the sound.
We just can't broadcast it over the air and terrestrial radio.
Right.
According to the American FCC.
Word, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, interesting.
There you go.
There you have it. I just thought I should probably explain what that weird noise was. Anyway, we'll take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, William Kay, while we talk about more stuff.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't
shot him with a poo. Bob.
So what if it's Easter Sunday? We've used the
the magic, dump button.
The magical dump button for the first time. We're playing Weird Al. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta love hanging out with the Canadians. thanks, William. This has been...
Oh, my pleasure.
This has been super fun.
I just wanted to plug the website.
Yes, please. I forgot.
www.ecofascism.com. Always new stuff coming out. Plus, I've been experimenting with YouTube lately.
You have. You've got a lot of
so
stuff on there.
Google my name, William Kay, and then Ecofascism. I did two or three myself. I did a bunch of interviews with a guy as well. There's more of that coming. I've got to really improve my technical skills a little bit, but you know, I did one that is just so controversial that I haven't even posted it yet.
Oh, get it up! Yeah,
what's the topic?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it really is very, very critical of the Pope.
Mm. Oh, well,
and
that's easy to do.
That's going to irritate people, and I'm going to do it for sure. And the next written posting is all going to be about land economics and how it comes to pass that housing prices are so exorbitant in many cities because the environmental movement has pulled so much land out of development and how they've surrounded all these cities with green belts. And this is obviously an effort to do what it is doing, which is driving up the price of commercial real estate and residential real estate to very unaffordable levels. And this isn't an accident.
And forcing people to live in rabbit hutches.
Well,
yes.
we just keep seeing...
And it's forcing its impact on the whole economy. I mean, there's studies saying that if they would just... You know, like Houston is the role model where they really just let the city sprawl and spread. And the housing costs remain very low there. And it's not as though there's any shortage of land in North America. Like some of the worst cities in the world for this sort of confined cities are Australia and Canada. Like the cities of Toronto and Vancouver are notorious. They created an area... 40,000 square kilometers. Think 15,000 to 18,000 square miles of land they took out of development around Vancouver. And it has now got the most unaffordable housing in the world. And it was next to Hong Kong.
And I'll testify to what you're saying is true. We have relations that live in Texas, and one of them lives in a house that is like a palatial mansion, would cost probably $2 million in California.
Well, move from the California Bay Area, sold a house, move there.
Pay cash.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it'd be a $2 million home easy here.
One of the big real estate companies in the States took a standard house, four-bedroom, 2,200-square-foot house, and put it in different cities and checked out the price. Houston, $230,000. San Francisco, $1.5
million. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a great comparison, yeah.
And the difference is land use planning. Because even around these coastal cities, like over there, there's 1,000 square miles around Portland, Oregon, that's been taken out of development. Mm. And even places like San Francisco, there's room to grow for these cities, but they've all been zoned out of development.
Yeah, that
but
makes perfect sense.
But this isn't an accident. I mean, the people who own the commercial real estate, the big landlords in the city, they want it that way. They really want to restrict access to new land. They like what it's doing. Like most businesses are our tenants. Most businesses do not own the premises out of which they operate. You know, dentists and coffee shops bars. They're usually tenants.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners of that commercial real estate, they don't want to see wide open capitalism. They don't want to throw open the city's fringe regions to development because all sorts of new commercial real estate would pop up along with new apartment blocks.
Hey, we'll get those new videos up, William. We're looking forward to seeing them, and we do appreciate you coming on. We're out of time, but
send them our way, and we can always post them on today's page because we have a lot of
Thank
people.
Thank you very much for having.
Yeah.
Over and out.
And out. Our guest, William Kay. Always a fun ride. Thanks a lot, guys. It's been a great day. See you next week.
Happy Easter.
Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Happy Easter from Casey at our Shasta Reading.